approve his appointment as a full professor after he had done a lot of good work. Okay?
Okay. We were going to talk about the advent of computers and how that was introduced into.
Yes. Chetty Slepcevich had used the computer at Johns Hopkins for somewhere for getting some numerical functions for his light scattering phenomena. Had a whole book published on it. And he was interested in computing, and of course the people in research were using the computer, the 650 I believe it was we had, and I was aware that it was coming. I had a man come from Standard in New Jersey, and he sat in my office as chairman, and I said to him, how long would you say it would be from a new graduate leaving here before he uses a computer? Would it be 2 months? I mean, 2 years or 3 years or how long? He said, well, why don't you say 2 or 3 months? And I said to him, you know, we aren't preparing our students for that sort of thing. It's time we did. And Chet Slepcevich and Joe Martin, who was a mathematical person too, who taught a math course, actually, when he came to teach with us in 46 or 7. I said to them, let's get a problem, an example problem, and run it through, and let's get the lectures for our faculty and graduate students on programming. We held the first lecture in February, and it must have been 58 or 59. Anyway, we held a lecture on an icy evening in an odd building in the university for graduate students and faculty, and 200 showed up. That was a intense interest. We put on an example problem, and we wrote a proposal for the Ford Foundation that they finance a project for us at the university for, I don't know, $250,000, $300,000. A fellow by the name of Woody Craig, I believe, who was under the head man of Ford Foundation project, and they were going into engineering then. They gave MIT $1 million or something, and or maybe two or three, and I believe Caltech or someone. Anyway, our project was put together to give us the funds to really teach our faculty and the graduate students well enough so that they would know how to put computers into the teaching process for engineering itself, not just research. They came back shortly with a project in which they nominated $900,000 as the amount, and that we take it on as a national project. And we did. I think we got the approval in September of 59. I visited 10 schools, selected 10 schools, MIT, Pennsylvania, Ohio State, Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, University of Texas, Georgia Tech, I suppose Berkeley. Anyway, I visited 10 schools. In the 10 schools, I found one problem that had been given an undergraduate student a statement of the problem and its solution available. It was from a man who was head of the computing center at Georgia Tech, and he also was a professor of engineering. The only problem. At MIT, I knew Gordon Brown through, I was on a committee for a commission on engineering education, and I knew a lot of the leaders, including Gordon Brown. I knew Nate, I can't think of his name, head of civil engineering at Illinois. So I knew the computing people. Well, anyway, I was through Educom, I guess, too. Anyway, I went to Gordon Brown, and he assembled his people. He appointed a committee to meet with me, because they had not addressed the subject yet. And this was true about came to Pennsylvania. And there was always some older people who sat there and said, you know, this isn't going to amount to much. It's going to be a flash in the pan. I had an MIT man who was head of the naval. He said, folks, you're just off the beam. The most a student will ever do is to say, you'll say to them, see this pack of cards? I'll put it in here and the thing will run out and I'll take out a pack of cards and I'll say, now there's a solution to your problem. That's as close as a man will ever come to the computer. And Brian said he was the head of chem engineering. He was the committee from chem engineering. He said, oh no, you don't understand. The computer use is a new thought process. You have to organize yourself. And the organization you will have to put it on the computer will give you a new way of looking at things. And that's the value of the computer. And, of course, the rapidity with which you can do it. And the man in civil engineering, he's working on a program himself for, you know, telling how much earth is required to make a new road and that sort of thing. And the young people, they just clobbered the old folks. I sat there and listened. I remembered it at Pennsylvania. I don't remember who it was, but anyway, the young people. So everywhere I went, I found two or three faculty people. And so I came back, and what I did was to select 150 people over a three-year. I got 3 years with the Ford Foundation and 2 years from the National Science Foundation for Computers and Engineering Design Education. We put on live designs, online designs, by 65, from 59 to 65. We had each person who came to us for a summer or semester had to do some example problems and publish them in their solution. And we sent the volumes to every school, engineering school in the free world we knew. I went to Brazil to teach in 63 for a semester. That was the end of the Ford project and beginning of the design one. And when I got there, I visited Argentina, and I went into the dean's office to make myself known. And he said, oh, you must meet my young man who runs the computing center for me. And I met him, and he had our reports and was using them. So it was a worldwide thing. And we made reports for every faculty person in the end of our project in a paper-bound division report, civil or mechanical or whatever, engineering, chemical engineering. And then we had a big volume of everything in it. We really started the thing, but it was very slow in coming. People who had not had it as a young person did not learn enough to synthesize the problems. I was one of those, you see. I taught a course in computing with introductory computing, and I could have a recitation but not give any lectures. But it was slow, and it's now here, but it was slow in coming.
And what kind of support, monetary support, developed, let's say, in your department during that time to provide the new equipment?
Well, you understand the $900,000 was used to help the computing center.
Okay.
But we tested small computers, the Bendix 15 or whatever it was, and another one. We tried the small computer in our lab to come there and use it, or the bigger one, the 704 or whatever it was afterwards, finally the 360. And what we found was that the people would be glad to use the larger computer because they'd do much better and quicker work, but if they had to stand in line 2 hours, they'd come and do it themselves on a smaller computer. That's what we learned. But it was really the discipline. We brought in a man from telephone laboratories who had... Pardon?
Bell Labs.
Yeah, Bell Labs. And he brought in, he gave a lecture on a computer appreciation course which should be given to every person that goes to a university. And we put it on lectures. And we had lectures on medical diagnosis with a computer. We had one on synthesizing music from Illinois. A chem engineer from Illinois, I believe it was, or chemist. But anyway, we tried to make an influence on the university. After we got this project, our math department started a course on the basics of computing to give through the computing center. So it was a cooperative project with the computing center, but I organized a committee at our college, a man from each department, myself. I got zero cooperation out of the dean's office, you see. That's another thing with the dean. He wasn't going to help me, and he appointed a new committee, and I already had one, you see. He didn't even know we had ours going. And the Ford Foundation had one question. Was I going to be in charge if they gave us the money? See, they knew the situation. But anyway, I, of course, was only the manager, a promoter, the pushing of the right people, I guess.
When computer science developed, did it end up residing in the College of Engineering?
No.
Or did it...
They have them both, but they've merged, I believe, right now. But it's in the electrical engineering now. The electricals were the biggest foot draggers I had.
Hmm.
They weren't in it yet. They were hardware-oriented, not program-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Elliot Organic was a man that was one of our graduate students in phase behavior who went to University of Houston, the computing center. I got him to come to be the technical director. He wrote the Fortran primer while he was here, but he also wrote a MAD primer because we had using the MAD language, which is a superior system we had at the time ahead of the recent Fortran 4. But he died last December, and somehow the people... He went to Utah to hit up a computing science department, not an engineering, just a science department at Utah. He had been to MIT to consult with them for a year before he went there. They had him come to help him set up the educational program for MIT. And he was our first man. I had another man from Kentucky, and the third man was our man... Bryce Carnahan, who's still with us.
How did the AICA... that looks like that. We have been talking about the introduction of computers. I was going to ask you when we stopped how the AICHE responded to the advent of computers in education for chemical engineers.
They did very well. They have a CAST, C-A-S-T, computer-aided simulation or something. I forgot what it is. It's now a private corporation run by chemical engineers for chemical engineering faculties.
I see.
Monsanto gave them their process design program 10, 15 years ago. And... our people were involved, and of course there is this a division now of the chemical engineers. I've forgotten the exact name of it, but it has to do with computers and mathematics. And our man Carnahan received one of the awards there. But it's a national thing. Are you familiar with EDUCOM? E-D-U-C-O-M?
Only through something that I think I have from you.
Well, EDUCOM was Educational Communication and something else. Anyway, it's an inter-university consortium. I was active with it because, 1966, because Jim Miller, who organized it, Dr. Jim Miller, who organized EDUCOM in the first place, asked the university to have me go there because I'd been in this computing work. I started, for example, the computing committee for the university as a whole, overview committee for university computing. And so I went there to a month in Boulder and helped them write a book called EduNet. It's supposed to be a communication network between universities with computers and for all technical use of technology in helping university function, both educationally and business-wise. This fellow Miller went on to be president of the University of Louisville. He was at Cleveland for a while at this Fenn,
mm-hmm.
Fenn place. He is a psychologist, was head of our mental health research institute. And then Arbor, and he got into this, you know, kind of a think tank person. Anyway, I got on the board as a function of this, and as a board, first thing I knew, they had me chairman of the board. And I had a man going who was just ill-fitted for the job. He got him hired without realizing that he knew what universities wanted. He would not visit any. He said, I don't need to go. I know what they need. And what they needed and what they wanted might have been two different things. So he refused to go. And for example, in bibliographical data banks, you know, how to find things, I had them all organized to get ready to have a meeting on data banks, what they were, and where they were around, and he just let it drop like a hot potato. And so I just plain said, let's get rid of them. And we hired Henry Chauncey, who just retired from the Educational Testing Service, as our chairman, and we moved the office from Boston there. And it's been taken over. He came from Harvard, of course, was an associate dean at Harvard, I think, when he went there in the first place. He's got Harvard and Stanford and MIT and these schools going, and it's a going institution now. 160 schools, I think, are in it. And our cash, C-A-C-H-E it is, I guess, C-A-C-H-E, I said it wrong a minute ago, is the would be the, one of the ideal ones. Now, I don't know how they handle the telephone lines or whatever they get for communication, but they do have a series of programs for chemical engineering. And it's one of the best. It was really the best example we could get out for Educom of saying how a profession should do this. We also have in Michigan, Michigan State, Wayne State, computer program, Merit, I believe it's called. Anyway, I was aboard on that. I presented the budget to the Joint Committee of the Legislature to get this thing going as a line item in the state. And we do have. And chem abstracts, for example, we have them and we share them with the two schools at one cost. And anything that's on any of the computing systems in these three schools can be used by anybody else on the other in the other schools. And it's a very good thing. Now, I've been promoting things like that. But I'm not really a mathematician or a... I did take a look at information science as such. I wrote a report for our department, for our college, to show them about information science that was coming along. I chaired a committee for the Engineering Foundation in New York and the EJC, these three engineering organizations, and the Engineering Center in New York, you know, the building they have there. I was not president of the ICHE when we... When we dedicated the building, I went there, met Herbert Hoover when he turned the spade for one of the presidents I met in an indirect way that way. So chem engineering has done pretty well, I guess, with the computing.
What's the situation at Michigan today in terms of building it into the curriculum?
It's coming, as I guess, close. You see, I'm not really involved in it because I've been out of teaching now, so you see, 10 years. But we have essentially computing available to everyone almost as much as they want, and the teachers are using computers in their instruction now pretty well. Textbooks are now becoming, you have a textbook and then you have a book of discs that you'll sell them if they want to buy them, so on. In my book I'm working now, my young Chinese boy, I'm saying to him, why don't you prepare the book of discs and essentially get the royalty on that, too.
I couldn't help but think, as I was looking through that handbook of natural gas engineering, I want to look at that and talk about that book. How much how helpful a computer would have been when you were doing an... a lot of those diagrams and calculations at that time.
Yes, that's true. I, for example, on this vapor liquid equilibria, I have run at least 1,000 calculations by hand, slide rule and then a small computer. And I gave lectures at Maracaibo, for example, to the University of DeZulia there, to people in gas engineering. One day I came back to them, I said to my wife, you know, they've got little desk computers, handheld computers, and they get the answer before I do on my slide rule. And she said, well, it's time you got a computer yourself. And of course I have. But I had an American Gas Association project on retrograde condensation and natural gas pipelines. And of course I went back and renewed my work in the field of phase behavior. And I set up with an Iranian boy who came to study with me and another young man there that a program for depletion calculations. And we use extended analyses. We go up to C15, C25 even. We even have properties to C45, generalized properties. And You take these reservoirs and you can put the computer program on. It'll run off a dew point. Then it'll run a depletion. You can say it's going to be produced to so much, run off a depletion at a specified pressure drops, and give you the composition at the wellhead and what the composition of the vapors and liquids. And if you have three separators in a row, it'll compute all three of them. I judge it would take a man year to calculate what this thing does in 2 minutes for $2. I mean, it's just astounding, because you see there, well, often like 30 constituents, you know, simultaneous equations and that sort of thing, trial and error you have to make. It's just impossible. So I did get back a little into it in computing with that.
Could you tell me more, since we've mentioned that the handbook, I think that's what you gave me, the Russian title page.
Yes.
Could you tell me more about that book and how it originated?
Well, okay. One of the things I did for the university, which so long ago people don't remember it anymore, was that Brown and I and a summer session dean by the name of Dorr, D-O-R-R, Harold Dorr, wanted to start a continuing education program for industry outside of the university extension division. The extension division had got it down to teaching real estate and a few other things. No pay for the man who did it. You know, he only did it because he couldn't get a better job, and it wasn't a very good one that way. So we started this in 1953, and the concept was, first person would make fresh notes he would use in the course. The second one was that he would be paid like he was doing consulting work or anything comparable, so that he could do it and not have to sacrifice to do it. And hopefully it would encourage him to get the notes into a book, a textbook. And started in 53 in phase behavior. And this went that summer. And at the end of the two-week course, we had a two-day symposium on phase behavior. And several of my former students came. And it so happened the ones who came, they said, well, why don't we write a book on the subject? And so I sat down, and the people that were selected were primarily those people who came to that meeting. There are six co-authors. Five out of the six were actual students. The sixth one was a person I had worked with for 20 years before that. I headed mine in 53. I took the years 1956-57 off as chairman, and half pay for a whole year is our sabbatical policy. It was my second sabbatical. And I wrote this book with the people. They wrote certain chapters and I wrote others. I turned out to be about, I called it 10 or 15% something for being an editor, of course, of everybody's. I was responsible for everything in this, finally. And put it together, and McGraw-Hill, and I was going to call it just a textbook, Natural Gas Engineering. When they got it ready to sell, it was so expensive, 800 pages, 8.5 by 11,
yes.
1,200 references, and of the 600 figures in there, 650, something like that, 250 of them were from my papers and my students, of course. And they said it's so expensive, and I said, well, it's kind of like a handbook. Many quantitative figures you use in engineering. Oh, we'll call it a handbook of natural gas engineering. And there was one little flaw that nobody understood, and I still have trouble with it. That immediately took it out of the college division and put it into the industrial division. They didn't even put it in the college catalog for books. Oh, and I have to fight with them, and they put it back in and then leave it out and do it poorly. I'm still having that trouble with the new book, because it should be half and half, college division and the industrial. I don't know if I'll make it or not. I sat with the president of McGraw-Hill about 15 years ago, and one of their young men wrote to me and said, well, your sale is down a bit. I'm going to only give you half your royalty from now on. And I wrote to the president and said, look at the kind of letter I'm getting from your outfit. This first place, the sale isn't down. It just whatever was too high, because it was an expensive book. And so he fixed it up for me. I don't know who the president, or he doesn't know me now, I guess, but in any event, it has sold down its 26th year. And the last 6 years, until maybe last year, it has sold better than it sold starting with the second year. Mm. Because of the uptake, half the sales are international. My man in Iran that I got to know well, he's using my book, and when we visited him, he's down in Scotland. I visited him 2 years ago, and he said, and he was telling his daughters, who were mother's Dutch, and he had to leave, of course, when the revolution came. He was telling them about me, and I said, well, you're really talking about, you know, my handbook is that. And he said, well, no. But I said, well, tell me, what's good about it? Well, he said, when I pick it up and read it, I feel like the person who wrote it actually did this and understood it and didn't read it out of a book somewhere or an article, see? And in a sense, that's what's made it go. It's really a compendium of the phase behavior, reservoir engineering type material, not oil recovery, but for gas, handling gas, that was known as of 1957.
Have you updated it at all?
That's what I'm doing right now, I see. But it can't be a full updating of everything. Some chapters are going to have to be left off. Mm-hmm. Because I'm writing it as for production and storage of gas, not oil recovery at all, hardly. I got to keep the size down. Just have it as a saleable book.
You did a lot of consulting work on pipelines.
Well, yes. I did work on, you appreciate that natural gas pipelines, you have to get engineering studies of reservoirs that supply the gas, then you have to get storage places near the market, because you can't afford to bring all the gas on that cold winter day from the source 1,000 miles away. So I worked on both ends. I started working on expanding the Michigan-Wisconsin pipeline that came from Texas to Detroit and Milwaukee. In that expansion, I studied the Hugoton Reservoir, out H-U-G-O-T-O-N, Hugoton, yeah, Reservoir in Kansas, and it went on down into Oklahoma and Texas. And I did a little problem where I said I calibrated the geologist. That was a bad thing to say, because it really gave them an inferiority complex. Geologists are quite qualitative often, you know. They're getting more quantitative at time. They looked at core, the cuttings. You know, when you cut with a drill, you get cuttings, a bag of cuttings. They were going to look at 20 bags for 700 wells. See, 20 bags of cuttings each well and 700 wells to find what kind of porosity the cuttings showed. And they had a classification system from 1 or 0 to 7. And I said, well, what porosity is number 5? Oh, they said, we don't know. We're just going to have to find some way of judging it or something. And I said, well, thank you, I'll find out for you. I gave the same team of geologists, 5 of them, I said, you classify these 2,000 cores. We've already tested those. They classified them, and I took that data and showed what the grades really meant, porosity and permeability. And it was proof that the eye of the geologist was a very good eye. It made a beautiful curve.